Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. CPA Trendlines presents an episode of The Disruptors.
Welcome to the Accounting Disruptor Conversation. I'm your host, Liz Farr from CPA Trendlines. My guest today is Blake Oliver, founder of Earmark CPE and co-host of the Cloud Accounting Podcast. How are you doing today, Blake?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me on, Liz. It is fun to be in the other seat since normally I'm the one interviewing people.
Well, you know, it's kind of cool to have a podcast pro on a podcast, and especially as one of my early guests. And so thanks a lot for agreeing to talk to me.
Happy to do it.
All right. Well, we've got lots to get through, so let's get started. Now, accounting talent, as you know and I know, has been pretty scarce for a long time, and COVID made that worse. Now, do you have any ideas on how to make things better? And what have you seen firms do successfully?
There's a lot of places we could go with that, Liz. I think the place to start that is the most relevant, given everything that's been going on recently, is work flexibility. So allowing staff to choose when they work, where they work, what hours they work, do they work from home, do they work from your office? Based on my conversations with accountants and firm owners, that is what is really driving a lot of this great resignation. It's that you have staff that have gotten a taste of what it's like to be able to work from home because of the pandemic, and they don't want to go back to the office, and they don't want to sit in that chair for 12 hours during busy season. They want to work the hours that are necessary to get their work done and to do it from anywhere. And I think this is made even more poignant by the recent letters that Intuit has been sending out to accountants. I don't know if you've seen these, Liz, but Intuit is hiring for TurboTax Live, for QuickBooks Live. And they sent letters out to accountants who are working in firms, offering them flexible work arrangements and didn't mention the salaries or anything, but which are probably not competitive, but still, I think they have an advantage in that regard because they're offering people flexibility, and the firms that are growing, they're really attracting staff, are offering people flexibility, and so I think that's what we have to be looking at as firm owners, as managers.
I agree. I think that flexibility is going to be a big key to the future. I certainly didn't have much option for that when I was in public accounting. And that was part of what chased me away from public accounting was the long hours and no flexibility. I mean, I could flex my hours. So I would come in at 8:30 instead of 8. And that meant that my commute was half an hour instead of 45 minutes. But that was about the limit of the flexibility that I had.
Yeah. For me, it's hard to imagine ever going back to work in any sort of traditional office job now that I can work from home, which I've been doing for a few years now. And, I have the ability to pick up my son from school at 3 p.m. So I clock out at 3 o'clock and I'll do a couple hours of work after he's asleep at night. Most firms wouldn't be able to handle that, right? It allows me to be present as a father in a way that my dad, who worked a corporate job, never was, right? He was always gone. Like, he'd get home often after we were asleep. So it's totally changed my relationship, with my family and for the better. And I think, it's hard, I think, for folks who haven't ever had that flexibility and have had those traditional roles in a family to imagine it, to even think that it's appealing, but it is. And so, I could never go back. I think there's a lot of people like me who would never go back to a traditional work schedule.
Oh, I totally agree. And another change that we've been seeing is the business model for accounting firms. Until recently, accounting firms really followed the same business model that they had for decades, billing by the hour and this rigid hierarchy. But you and I both know firm owners who were doing things quite differently. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen firm owners doing?
Yeah. I mean, the, what is the traditional model? It's basically a pyramid scheme, right? It's bring in staff, work them really, really hard, in public accounting anyway, so that you're billing out lots of hours, time-based. So it's important to make them sweat. And then, you know, the profits flow to the top, to the partners. And that has worked for years and years and years. Not that long, actually, right? What, like less than 100 years that that's been in place, but it's been very effective. But it's starting to fail because we don't have enough talent anymore. We've got a talent shortage. So this whole, you know, pyramid scheme, this triangle shaped firm just doesn't work. And especially when you've got technology coming in with these startups that are offering accounting and bookkeeping services that are under a corporate model, that's challenging this traditional partnership model. And I think we're going to see a lot of accounting firms that are just no longer going to be accounting firms. You've got Eisner Amper deciding not to be an accounting firm anymore. They took on private equity. They split off the audit practice into a separate entity. And they're really focused on growing consulting and tax under the non-accounting firm, the non-CPA firm. And you've got firms like Acuity. They just hit $10 million in revenue, over 100 employees, and they're growing really fast in Atlanta. They're not at a CPA firm. You've got the VC-backed startups like Pilot and Bench providing accounting services. You've got TurboTax Live basically turning into a full-service tax firm in many ways. QuickBooks Live, Intuit is offering bookkeeping. So like that's a threat, right? And I think that the whole business model has to be looked at again. And I think we'll see a lot of firms switch to probably a corporate structure where and that means too, that like to me, that means giving staff ownership so that it's no longer this two-tier system where you've just got partners with equity and you've got staff who work. I think we're going to see more managers and even staff with equity.
I think that that'll be an interesting trend. You know, I've seen a few top 200 firms that are overlaying the CEO, CFO, COO structure on top of partners. But, you know, yeah, I do hear you that people will really want equity if they're going to be sacrificing that much of their lives. That's something that we can learn from the startup world, is the desire for equity, having some skin in the game.
Yeah. And that was basically the choice that I was given when I lived in LA. I was a manager at a top 25 firm, and I was recruited by a startup in the accounting space. And the startup was offering me stock options, and the potential payout could be millions of dollars for a few years of work. And the accounting firm offered me a path to partnership that was incredibly opaque, and I had no idea when it would happen or what the results would be. And so hold those two things side by side and decide, you know, which one is a better bet. And for me, it was the stock options. So yeah, we got to do a better job at making the rewards of becoming partner like clearer to people. And I know that even when you become a partner, often you don't really see the benefit for a long time. So,
yeah, I mean, you maybe get a bigger paycheck, but you also tend to work an awful lot of hours.
Yep. And you can't cash out your equity easily.
No.
Right? No.
No.
So.
No. I've seen firm owners that were kind of trapped because they really did want to get out, but there was nobody who was willing to buy them out. I talked to somebody at Digital CPA who told me that he was miserable and wanted to get out, but here he had this business that was supporting about 25 people and he couldn't just shut the door and walk away. He had to provide for them somehow and he didn't know how to do that.
Yeah, and that's where something like, you know, I don't know how this would actually work in practice, but an employee stock ownership plan, right? Could work, get the employees to buy the firm eventually. Mm-hmm. But you really got to like start that 10 years ago, not now. That's the thing.
Yeah. 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 Now, what about growing? You know, how do firms grow? You know, we hear a lot about scaling and growing. Are there different strategies for solo firms or multi-partner firms? What do you think?
Well, and there's so many different ways you could grow. I think it's funny, actually, when I talk to firms that are growing, a lot of them have been going down this acquisition path because that's the traditional way that you grow as a firm is, you know, once you reach a certain size, reach a few dozen employees, you say, okay, I'll just roll in other firms. And they're actually finding that it's harder in some ways to acquire a firm than it is to just acquire the business organically. And I think the reason is that it's most accounting firms don't do any organic sales and marketing. And by that, I mean advertising online, having dedicated salespeople who don't provide accounting services, that just sell the services you have, like having a real sales department. And if you do that, like, it's really easy actually to acquire clients from what I'm hearing. And in my experience too, right? I had a professional sales guy in my firm, and it was easy pickings. We'd just go find the clients, or they'd find us that weren't happy with their current provider. And again, like, most firms aren't doing a very good job of, like, retaining clients either. And they've got too much work anyway, right? So that's the thing. It's almost too easy.
Yeah, you know, the firms that I was at certainly didn't have anybody doing sales or really any kind of coherent marketing strategy. You know, I'd look at their websites, and you know, I was starting out as a writer when I was still in public accounting. So I offered to redo the websites and do blog posts and send out a newsletter. And almost no one took me up on that, because I don't know whether it was lack of imagination or because the person who was already doing the marketing didn't want to share that with anybody else.
It might just be that, like, most firms aren't used to seeing results from that kind of effort. You know, and as a marketer, somebody who's gone into marketing, I can tell you, you'll do a lot of stuff that doesn't get a result, or it's hard to trace it. And so that's tough. It's tough for a partner to say, I'm going to invest X dollars and then not be able to tie it to a result. And that's just the way marketing can be. I also know that, you know, there's stats, actually a stat from CPA Trendlines that I saw recently that said that 100% of firms rely on referrals from existing clients to get new ones. Referrals, right? Classic, traditional. Only 58% get clients from their website. Only 58%. That's, like, not that much, really.
Right.
Right. Everybody should be getting clients from their website. And then only 24% get them from social media and 8% from other internet channels. Right. So, like, that it's just not common, right? CPA firms haven't been doing that much in terms of marketing, except for the bigger ones. But you know, even the bigger ones, it's more like the marketing is done at the individual partner level, like marketing that person, not as much marketing the firm as the solution for your business that can do all this other stuff. So then that's where the startups are doing a really good job, right? You just go look at the accounting firm startups that have popped up, like Pilot, see what kind of marketing they're doing. They know what they're doing, right? They have to acquire lots of clients really, really fast in order to meet their goals. So it's worth a look. It can be a really good inspiration.
Yeah. And, you know, even though a lot of firms have relied on referrals for decades as a reliable source of new business, not all referrals are created equal.
Yes.
And so I know that I worked with an awful lot of terrible clients who were referred to us by a great client, but we kept them on basically because we didn't want to annoy our great client, who was the one who sent them to us. And so we were stuck with these really awful, crazy people. And that wasn't any fun.
Yeah. And that's sort of the, we take all comers kind of problem as well, right? Where most firms don't really specialize. And so that creates a challenge too, right? If you specialize, then it's a lot easier to, you know, distinguish yourself from the crowd and attract the right kind of clients. And that's what I see other firms doing as well too, is really going the specialty route.
Yeah. I talked to a few people at Digital CPA who were heavily specialized. You know, and there were some very narrow specialties that I hadn't even really thought of as possible avenues for getting a lot of clients, but they were doing very well with very specialized niches. Now, what skills do accountants need to be successful today and in the future? You know, it used to be you had to be really good with a 10 key and you had to carry the IRS code in your head. What do people need today?
Well, I think being really good at Google helps with anything these days, right? Like, I joke that most of my success can be attributed to, like, whatever, the small success I've had, it can be attributed to being able to like look things up on the internet. So yeah, you don't need to memorize the tax code anymore. You just need to understand it broadly. And that's where the CPA exam has trouble with right now. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of it was memorization of rules, regulations, but we all have all this at the tip of our fingers now. So like, do we really need to do that anymore? It's more about critical thinking. It's more about problem solving, and accounting programs just have a tough time like teaching that. So I'm glad that I was a liberal arts major because, mm-hmm. you know, I studied music. I studied literature. I studied history. And so, you know, that for me was like how I got to be like a broad-minded individual. And that has helped me a lot in my career. So I think, you know, a lot of the, well, if we're going to talk about, you know, specific stuff in accounting, if you, you know, technical stuff, I think finance, FP&A is where the action's at. And so the way this ties into accounting is, imagine if instead of just presenting clients with a 12 months of actuals financial report, if you could present to them 6 months of what happened and then 6 months of what's going to happen and be able to forecast for them reliably and in a systematic way. I think that is where the value is at when it comes to a lot of the basic accounting services that we're providing now to clients. Specifically when it comes to like client accounting services, which is where, you know, I come from. So when I'm talking to people who are doing bookkeeping, outsourced accounting, that's what I say. I say, learn how to do FP&A, learn how to do financial planning and analysis and be able to forecast and budget for your clients in a like systematic, you know, way where there's a method and it's not just guesswork. And I suppose maybe you could say the same thing for tax, right? I mean, the best people in tax have always been doing planning, which is all about forecasting what's going to happen. And if you don't have a reliable forecast, how can you plan? So that all ties together.
Right. You know, and unfortunately, most people equate tax planning with just the cash flow planning to make your tax payments.
Yeah, that's just like the basic level, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just telling you, well, in April, you're going to have to write a check for this much. Do you have the cash flow to do that? Just giving you heads up that you're going to have to do that. Yeah. But that's not really much help. That's not really helping them to see what they can do in their business that will move the levers one way or another.
Yeah. And so that's where combining forecasting with the tax planning can be helpful because you need to understand the business owner's goals. And if their goal is to sell their business in 5 or 10 years, and you build that into your forecast and you are planning for that, you can probably structure the deal that they do end up doing in a way that saves them a lot of money. And that's where you can create a tremendous amount of value. You could save somebody millions of dollars potentially. And you do that one time, and then you can go tell people, you know, that you did this and do that for others. And, you know, the value of that is just, it's hard to calculate.
You're giving me some ideas of a sideline I could do, Blake, because in a past life, I even had a CVA for a while. So I did do some business valuation. So I did do that. So.
And what I like about this, you know, we're just thinking about this off the top of our heads. What I like about this idea is that it brings together groups that may not talk to each other much in a firm. And that's another problem, which is that you have these siloed groups providing services under in a firm.
Yeah.
And that's like, it needs to be more cohesive so that everybody's on the same page. And it's not just, oh, this group here provides historical bookkeeping. This book group here provides tax. They don't talk really, you know?
Yeah, I was in two firms that had kind of opposite philosophies. There was one firm where I did interact an awful lot with the A&A team, partly because they pulled me into audits all the damn time, but also because they really relied on the tax people for their tax provisions. They ran that by us. And we shared a lot of the same work papers. We shared clients. We really worked together. The same thing with our client accounting services people. They would really help us to get the adjustments into our clients' books and to help me get information out of the books. They were really very valuable in that way. And then at another firm, all these areas were just isolated from each other. They didn't talk to each other. They didn't even know each other, really. You know, one firm, I was there for about 4 months, and I really didn't even meet all the people in the A&A department. So,
yeah, it's interesting, right? The culture can be very different from one firm to another.
Very, very different. You know, the A&A side had really good retention of team members, but over in tax, it was about 100% turnover about every 18 months.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, that was pretty, yeah. Pretty harsh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking about what accountants should start doing, but what should accountants stop doing immediately?
That's a good question. Well, I think, I don't know, we're coming up on busy season, right? It's December as we record this. January, February, March are coming. And I don't really understand the whole feast and famine kind of culture of most firms where you just wreck yourself during busy season. And I almost feel like, I mean, maybe this is crazy to say, but if we were just less greedy, then we wouldn't have to work so hard in tax season. Mm-hmm. Like if we just accepted we're going to make a little less money as a firm, but we're not going to kill ourselves. We'll just take on fewer clients during busy season. We could have a nice lifestyle. And you know, maybe that's not every firm, but I know there's plenty of firms where the partners are making, you know, $500,000 or more. Mm-hmm. How much money do you need? How much, will it ever make you happy? So I'd almost take a step back and say what does this money mean to me if I'm losing my life for it?
Right.
I definitely feel that way. You know, I moved from Los Angeles to the Phoenix area, so I don't have to work so hard anymore to make a good quality of life. So mm-hmm. I would always look at every job I take now from that perspective. It's like, how much of my life is this going to cost me?
That's a really good perspective, you know, because so often as accountants, we're just trained to accept the status quo of this is how it is. And I've heard that same sentiment from other people I've talked to in the series, that accountants are just so used to the way it has been that making any kind of change is really difficult because they don't have the imagination to see what else could be there.
Yeah. I see debates on Twitter sometimes about mandatory Saturdays during tax season. And there's firms that have dropped them completely. There's firms that it's almost sacrilegious to suggest that you wouldn't come into the office on a Saturday. And I think to myself, how is this possible, right? Like, how can you have some firms that have figured out how to do it without the Saturdays, and you have all these firms that can't figure out how to do it without the Saturdays? I mean, just to me, it means it's not necessary, right? There's ways to get around it. So, like you said, there's a lot of assumptions that we have in this profession that are being challenged. And it all comes back to this great resignation thing, which is the pandemic has disrupted a lot of things, and it has disrupted how we think about work and how we think about our careers. And, you know, I don't have any desire to follow a traditional career path at this point in my life. You know, I'm 38, no way. I would never go back. And a lot of people, I think, are that way too. And if you really want to see the youth of accounting in their thoughts, go to Reddit. Mm-hmm. Check out the Reddit threads on accounting.
Right.
And you'll see people are actually calculating it. They'll say, this is accounting. I love this. You know, you have accountants actually calculating what it would cost if they had to go back to the office and they couldn't work remote, given the amount of time they spent commuting and all this stuff. And a lot of them are saying it's at least $10,000, $20,000 of my life right there. Mm-hmm. And they're not even calculating all these other benefits into that. So they're not going to go, you know, they'll take a lower pay cut. I saw a survey that somebody did on Reddit, asking, you know, how much of a salary cut would you be willing to take to reduce your hours proportionately? And a bunch of people said, I would take 30% less pay for 30% fewer hours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you're a firm that is you could potentially take advantage of that by offering below market salaries, but offer people 70% of the work, let mm-hmm. them have their work-life balance, right? If they can go move somewhere more affordable and enjoy life, I think there's plenty of people who might take you up on that.
Yeah. And I talked to a couple people at Digital CPA who said the same thing, that if you offer flexibility, then maybe you don't have to offer the highest pay.
Yes.
But
you don't get into this bidding war that we're having right now.
Right.
For talent. Yeah.
Right. Right. But there are so many other intangibles, you know, and, you know, we keep coming back to the status quo and how accountants really need to change this. But what is it that keeps accountants from changing? What are the blocks that keep accounting firms from changing?
I think it's a partner model doesn't like change. It's resistant to change. There's this attitude that I suffered, so you have to suffer too. You see that? People will straight up say it. There are CPAs who think that keeping it difficult to get the CPA from a red tape standpoint, like 150-hour requirement standpoint, is good because it limits the supply of CPAs and so it increases their value. That's false. It actually is going to decrease our value because if there aren't enough CPAs, people will go outside our license to find the talent they need. So it's a lot of just changes come really quickly. And when change comes quickly to a profession and disrupts it, it's sometimes very difficult, I think, to convince people to change, especially when it's working. Like, it's not working particularly well, but it works, right? Like, firms grow, traditional firms grow. They don't grow very fast, but they can grow. They struggle. They make do. It's not fun, but they get by, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so the model, the problem is that the model isn't actually broken, but you have this new model that's popped up that is on the verge of disrupting it to the point where the old model does break. So we're at this, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse until you have a traditional firm where, I mean, I was on a webinar and somebody chatted in saying that he's a manager. And this year, in the last like month, every single one of their staff and seniors has quit.
Wow.
Yeah, there's nobody but managers, directors, partners left. And think about that going into busy season. That's a firm where it's breaking.
That's not breaking, that's broken.
Yeah, it's broken, right? We'll see if that firm is around. And that's why it's so easy now as a startup offering flexible work arrangements to these staff. You get them on your team, and then you go out and you pick off the clients from that firm that can't service them properly anymore. Mm-hmm. That's probably what's going to happen, right? Those staff are going to find jobs somewhere. So they'll find them at firms that offer flexibility.
Yeah. You know, and the ones that I really feel sorry for are the partners who are close to retirement, who have made it this far with this model and now just need to get out. But now they're left holding something that isn't very valuable anymore. What are they going to do?
Yeah. And I feel strongly for that, for them too. Like, that sucks. It's sort of like you played the game by the rules and now the rules have changed and it's not going to deliver you the payout that you were promised. And I don't know, like, is there a solution? If you don't change something, then you're going to end up selling your firm for a fraction of what it should be worth. But you know, like, firm valuations, traditional firm valuations are dropping, right? While the valuations for modern firms are increasing. So I don't see that changing, right? So maybe the best thing to do would be, you know, convince one of these staff who are going to leave to stay and fix the firm. And you're going to have to bite the bullet and just give them a piece of it.
Yeah.
So giving up a piece of it to your current employees, like letting them buy into the firm so that you can fix it, is probably going to be a better bet than just letting it fade away. That's my feeling, but I guess it'll depend on a case by case basis, right? What's possible. I guess this is why a lot of folks close to retirement are merging in to larger firms.
Yeah.
So there's this race, right? Where the small under 10 person firms are just looking for all the opportunity they can to merge in to a bigger firm. Right.
Yeah,
that's your other option.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a lot of that in New Mexico with single partner firms merging into bigger firms. And, you know, I suppose that's a way to manage for a while, but I'm not sure that that will completely solve all the problems.
Yeah. Well, and those firms may eventually get full, right? Not be able to take on any more small firms for a while. So it's sort of a race to see who can do that first. And as some of them have expressed to me, some of those owners have expressed to me, it's in some ways it's easier for them just to go out and get the clients organically rather than to bring your staff in and have to train people who don't know any of these processes. Like think about it this way. I could take my pick of your staff who are willing to learn and just take, you know, those people come to me, I can recruit them rather than taking on all of your staff who, you know, some of those people might be resistant to change. So Yeah, I think you kind of got to move now, right? There's the longer you wait, the worse it's going to get.
Yeah.
Although maybe we could get some of this VC money. People have talked about this. Get a bunch of this venture capital money and go just, you know, get a bag of money and just go and start buying up small firms, right? At a discount. And, but then, you know, everyone talks about that, but the actual work to like create the bigger firm is enormous and to make it all work together is enormous.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the firms that I was at for about a year and a half, was a single owner firm, and that guy did everything on paper. This was just 2015. This was 2016 when I started there. So he was still doing everything with paper in 2015. And well,
that is amazing. That is hard to believe, but I believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I came in and developed the paperless workflow that they used for a while, and then I left, and I don't know what they did, but.
See, what they should have done is incentivize you to stay. They should have said, this is brilliant. Liz, will you stay? And we will give you ownership and fix the rest of it. But they obviously didn't have that vision.
No, they didn't have that vision. And at the time I was on my way out of public accounting anyways, so. Wouldn't have mattered that much. Well, you know, CAS has been big for a while. What do you think is the next big thing?
The metaverse?
Possibly.
I think that's a long way off. I just think it's so funny that like everybody's up in this metaverse idea when, yeah. Anyway, what is the next big thing? I mean, honestly, the profession moves so glacially that I think CAS is going to be a big opportunity for a long time. And it's what it is the big frontier is not seeing CAS as its own thing. It's seeing CAS as integrated into everything else the firm does. So The best firms, the firms that are doing the best are the ones where they offer tax and advisory work as the main drivers of value in the firm. So I guess what I'm saying is that advisory is the future, but not advisory as you've been sold it. It's advisory as we'll do your bookkeeping for free. We won't charge you for bookkeeping. Oh, by the way, we'll also do your tax returns for free. Only though, if you subscribe to our advisory services. That's the future, I think, because there's very little value in bookkeeping and tax. So why not give it away as a part of your advisory offering? So that's why I'm telling bookkeeping shops, CAS practices, you need to do forecasting, because then you could do advisory around CFO type forecasting and budgeting. And you can give away the bookkeeping because that's just a component of it. That just is what helps you get to the forecast and the budget. So same thing with tax, right? Offer tax planning, do the tax return for free. Now you can still offer the tax prep as like a lower tier option where people just pay for the tax return. But it's very compelling. If you offer people two choices, you say, look, I'll just prepare your taxes for X dollars, or I'll prepare your taxes for free. And you subscribe to my tax planning advisory service that includes, maybe it includes retirement planning and like investment advice and all that stuff, right? You can do that. There's ways to do that through the right entities. Right. Offer that to people, right? They'll sign up. So I think that's the future. It's not actually creating anything new in terms of services, just selling them differently, bundling them differently.
I think you're onto something there because, you know, for a long time, we've been trained as CPAs that what we produce is what we sell is our time. And our time is used to prepare this meaningless piece of paper that has numbers and boxes, you know, whether it be a tax return or financials. But what clients really want and need, even if they don't really know that they want and need that, is what can I do to make my business better? And yep. we've help, been
help getting been, to their goals. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. You know, and how many firms do you know of who actually take the time to ask their clients, their new clients, what are your goals? What's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan?
They don't. And it's a catch-22 because they have too many clients right now to spend any time with their clients. So it's really hard to start that kind of practice when you've got, you know, I don't know, 1,200 tax returns that you do personally, which is a lot. And mm-hmm. and so you've got to cut down on the clients if you want to offer that kind of service. But that's great because then you'll have more time for fewer clients. But it's tough to do because you have to basically give up revenue while you do that. You know, you're building up a new practice while you're shedding the old one. And that it's hard to do that without a drop. So most people just aren't willing to do it. They're stuck on the treadmill. So yeah, I think that's the dream. I mean, well, here's an example of that. Just kind of make it real for people in terms of value. So I hired an attorney to help me with my trademark application for my new business, Earmark, mm-hmm. CPE, which you mentioned. And she offered me a fixed fee to do this rather than an hourly rate, which I jumped at. Mm-hmm. I love fixed fees. And the fixed fee mm-hmm. included preparing the application, submitting the application, and then any correspondence with the trademark office necessary to get it done, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to guarantee that I'm going to get the trademark, but it just includes everything from start to end. There's some out of scope mm-hmm. stuff too, but right. you know, right. generally. And that was great because I bet she spent maybe a few hours on this thing and her hourly rate was probably way higher than if she just charged me on, you know, like as an hourly attorney, right? Mm-hmm. But to me, I still got the value because we probably had like a 15-minute conversation at one point during this process where her expertise, because she specializes in trademark applications, made me avoid a huge mistake that would have cost me a area of the trademark that I really needed.
Oh,
so what yeah. she was selling me, right, was her expertise. I've done hundreds of trademark applications. So it doesn't matter how much time she spent. And, you know, that's how we should be thinking as accountants. Like it's our knowledge that matters, our years of expertise that matters, not how many hours we spend on something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I completely agree with you. It's the expertise, not the time. And, I think that's probably the perfect note to end this all on. It's been great catching up with you, Blake, and seeing you again.
Likewise.
Thanks for your time. Now, if people want to connect with you, where's the best place to find you?
You can reach me on my personal website, blakeoliver.com, but I'd rather you go check out my new app, which is Earmark CPE, and you can go to earmarkcpe.com. Check it out. It's an app for iPhone, Android that lets you get continuing professional education, NASBA approved CPE credits for listening to podcasts, accounting and tax podcasts. So I've got my own podcasts on there. I'm working on getting other podcasts, other authors on the platform. And the idea is just that in an hour a week, you can fulfill your CPE requirement for the year.
Oh, definitely. I'm on board. And maybe eventually this podcast will be one of those featured on Earmark. That would
yeah,
be cool.
It would be perfect, right? Let's get CPA Trendlines on Earmark.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, that's a great way to end. Thanks so much, Blake. And I look forward to seeing you again in person again.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com. Now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to CPATrendlines.com.